thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward, director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, and sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Diane is back on Thursday. Well, wheat prices jumped last week, leading to some fears that costs for basic consumer products like bread and cereal would also rise. Joining us to discuss the effect of weather and fire and damaged wheat crops on food supplies globally in our studios is Maximo Torero. He's the of the International Food Policy Research Institute, and Alan Tracy of U.S. Wheat Associates. Joining us from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana, Professor Chris Hurt of Purdue University, and from the BBC in Moscow, William Maudlin of the Malden of the Wall Street Journal. So greetings to all of you. Thanks for coming in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Thanks. Hurt, I'd like to start with you, if I could, from Purdue University. This discussion about wheat and wheat prices and the fires we're seeing in Russia and the crackdown on or the banning on of their exports and the concerns in Australia, I mean, sort of a global thing on a global commodity. Why should we care?
Well, we obviously should care because we're dealing with a basic food item. Wheat is the most consumed item, most basic to generating human needs in terms of the globe. And so when we're tight in terms of food supplies, it may be an inconvenience for some of us in the developed world. It may be some higher cost. But for those in the developing world, it can even be more tragic than that. It can be very high food prices, doubling of food prices there, and just the sheer unavailability of food. Very important.
You know, it seems, Alan Tracy, that sometimes this is an obscure conversation, but the cost of bread has led to revolutions. We think of the French Revolution, right? And more recently, to riots in the streets. This is something that moves from farm to and field to homes and communities very rapidly and potentially very profoundly, even in the 21st century.
Yes, and that's also why it leads to the political leaders. You see that it has a huge political impact. And even in countries that where rice is the staple, wheat is still in those countries and a part of the picture. So the action in Russia was political. The potential impact on places like Egypt or Pakistan can be very serious.
How significant is wheat in the American agricultural picture in American exports around the world?
That's a good question. We have a number of major crops. Corn and soybeans are the two largest, but wheat is right up there after them. If you take the entire U.S. wheat crop and put it on trucks and put them nose to nose, they would stretch all the way across the country. On semis.
That's so significant.
That's significant. And we export about half of that. And that brings in about it brings in $5 to $6 billion into the U.S. So it's very significant to our producers. It's globally the crop that's grown on more acreage than any of those other crops. So it's certainly one of the major crops. And because we consume it directly, not just here, but all the way around the world, it does have an impact on our diets and on our lives.
Maximo Torero, are you worried about what's happening in the developing world in particular? Are you watching that particularly closely?
No, sure. I think it's very important. And just to follow up on what was said before, wheat production, the U.S. is the first exporter of wheat. So it is very important in terms of the market. Now, why is this important in developing countries is because consumers could be affected by transmission of prices. But what needs to be clear is that the effect of the change in price of wheat will have a very small effect over the change of price in bread, because it's one of the many inputs that you use to produce bread. So, for example, a 1% increase in price of wheat will only affect 0.2% of the price of bread. And most developing countries, especially in Eastern Africa and West Africa, not necessarily are dependent on wheat consumption. But again, any change in prices could affect consumers a lot.
William Maudlin, let's come to you. You're in Moscow right now, and we've been reading and seeing a lot of pictures about the fires and the summer and the heat and the ban on wheat exports as a result. But before you get to the wheat, why don't you give us a sense of what the day is like and has been like in Moscow?
Sure. Well, I'm sweating right now. I've
Just made my way to the studio here, but it's a very hot day. Not as hot as some of the records we've had this summer. In the last few weeks, we've set several all-time records.
Have you still got smoke in the air and all this kind of business?
Today's a little bit clearer. The visibility's about several kilometers in Moscow, which is better than several hundred meters as it was a few days ago. So yesterday was probably the worst smoke day, but today is much better. The wind came in and blew some of that away.
I mean, bottom line, you're
other parts of Russia.
You're dealing with record heat and record-breaking drought. Is that not right?
That's right. A climate official in Russia said yesterday that this appears to be the worst heat wave Russia has ever had since its modern history began, you know, more than 1,000 years ago in Kiev. So it's amazing heat, and it's killed the grain crop. It's been a serious drought, and there's wildfires everywhere.
I want to get to the wheat thing in a minute. But is this? Are people there saying that this is just sort of quirky weather, bad luck, or are they making direct connections to global warming with all of this?
I don't think they're making direct connections. It's so anomalous. It's so abnormal to have a summer this hot. If there were several in a row, you'd start to think about it. But it's almost like it came from outer space. I mean, people here are not used to this type of heat. You can't buy an air conditioner anywhere. And there is some climate pattern at work, but you know whether it'll be replicated again. We certainly hope not.
So what's the wheat situation in Russia? Because we've heard some very dire comments from that country and implications for its exports, which then spill into some of the developing countries that Maximo was talking about a moment ago.
Sure. Well, the crop keeps dying, and we don't know how far it's going to go because they keep lowering the forecast. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin yesterday lowered the forecast a little bit more, to 60 to 65 million tons of wheat. But today we had the Grain Union saying they think the harvest will be above that official agriculture ministry assessment. So this could be the bottom of the estimates, and we might get something around 65 million, anywhere from 60 to 70 million tons of wheat from what the experts are saying right now. That's much less than the 97 million tons that Russia harvested last year.
That's a big drop from last year. So what are the implications of that, William Tracy?
Well, just one point. That's
Alan
those
Tracy,
figures are all grains, not just wheat, but about two-thirds of it is wheat. And a lot of the wheat in Russia is winter wheat, so it's ready to harvest. There's only so much more damage you can do to it at this point. But the spring wheat, of course, is really toast. And there are the other grains. Believe it or not, Russia does grow a modest amount of corn and actually usually exports some corn. Now, this year, they're likely to import corn. Our supply-demand picture on corn globally is worse than it is in wheat, so I think we may see that impact coming at us down the road.
Maximo, what does this all mean from what we're hearing in Russia for food supplies, prices?
Yeah, it's very important to bring some numbers and to put this in context. Russia produces 8% of the global production and only 11% of the exports. So we're talking of a 1.6% of decrease in global production. So that shouldn't be increasing the prices as we have seen before. So this loss of 20,000 percent of the production of Russia shouldn't be having the effect we have seen since Wednesday in terms of the increase in price. So what this is telling us is that markets are pretty volatile and they will react or overheat when you have these types of supply shocks. And that is what we need to find a way to transfer the correct information so that wrong decisions are not made in the process. What will be terrible, for example, will be dramatic if other countries start to follow Russia and start to put export bans. Then, of course, you will put more pressure over the supply, and that could have consequences over prices.
Are there indications other export bans may be in the offing?
We hope not, because basically Russia has enough stocks right now to resolve their problem. And by putting these export bans, what they are looking is to renegotiation of contracts. So what is important, and if you have seen in the last days, is the price have started to stabilize to what fundamentals are supposed to say, which is basically capturing the global picture. That is what needs to happen. Information needs to flow in the correct way to avoid governments making decisions that could really create this domino effect that you want to not to happen.
If you've got comments or questions about wheat, grain, corn, the price of food, commodities, call us at 1-800-433-8850, or you can drop us an email at drshow@wamu.org. I'd like to come back to Purdue University and Chris Hurt for your perspective on this, looking at this of, you know, from a 20,000-foot perspective when we talk about the shortages of wheat and what's happening in Russia. Implications for other grains like corn, a little conversation about that here, but take us out a bit.
Sure. And I think we need to expand just a bit more. We've talked about Russia a lot, but it's really an area around the Black Sea that extends beyond Russia. And as we look in that area, also in the Black Sea, you have Ukraine on the north side of the Black Sea. Ukraine is the sixth largest exporter of wheat in the world. And Kazakhstan also is important in that region. They're the seventh largest exporter. So when you put Ukraine and Kazakhstan together, they export about as much wheat as what Russia does. We also see this heat generally across parts of Central and Western Europe. So I think what that is saying is that it is broader than just Russia. Russia is the focal point, but it is broader. Now, again, following just a little bit in terms of the world situation, while we do have these cutbacks and Russia has made a political decision to shut off exports to evaluate their situation, the U.S. is the largest exporter in the world, and we are loaded with wheat. We have a very large inventory in the United States. That inventory is the largest in decades. And so we, I think, are largely going to be able to help the world here in terms of supplying this shortfall that has occurred. Now, again, the concern would be that we have other follow-throughs with other bad weather yields. But right now, I think we have to agree that these prices maybe got a bit excessive. So we look at food prices. The increase here in the United States in wheat price probably isn't going to be enough to substantially increase food prices overall.
Okay, hold your thoughts. We're going to come back to this conversation, what it means for you in the grocery store and your wallet on The Diane Rehm Show. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today, and we're talking about the devastation and destruction among some of the wheat crops in Russia and beyond, the impact of the droughts that have been taking place, and the implications for global food supplies and costs. And we're joined on the phone now by Jerry McReynolds. He's president of the National Association of Wheat Growers. He's a wheat farmer from Woodston, Kansas. And I understand, Jerry, you're joining us from one of your fields.
Yes, I am.
The magic of technology. We'll hope your cell line holds. So we've been having this. What's your weather out there?
It's going to get hot today. It's going to be over 100 degrees. So I'm spraying early today before the wind and the heat hits.
What are you spraying?
I'm spraying ground, preparing for wheat.
Okay, so you're going to grow more of this stuff. This is a good thing. Jerry, you're an American farmer, obviously, and you're president of the National Association of Wheat Growers, so you're looking at this from a very distinctly, you know, on the ground, if you'll pardon the pun, American perspective. When you see these incredible pictures and stories from Moscow and hear about an export ban and all that kind of thing, what's going through your mind about what it means for you and for other American farmers?
Well, first of all, I feel sorry for those producers, because I've been there. We've had those kinds of things happen, whether it be hail or drought. So I hurt for the producers. But it also is somewhat pleasing for us as American producers, because we're in a position where we have high quality. We produce a very high quality hard red winter wheat and other classes of wheat. And we can store that wheat, and in a very short period of time, we can get wheat anywhere in the world if it's required. So hopefully that helps bump our price up just a little bit, but I do feel for those farmers.
Is the world's pain American farmers' gain in this case?
I didn't catch your question, I'm sorry.
Is the world's wheat pains American farmers' gains in this case?
Well, maybe for the short term. There'll be some, providing they have wheat to sell. And many producers in my part of the country have sold a lot of their wheat already. Bills come up, and we have to be prepared to pay the bank and get on with the next crop. And so a lot of that wheat has already been sold at the previous price.
All right, Jerry, you stay with us for a minute. We're going to go from your farm fields there in Kansas back over to Moscow. And William Malden, who's the deputy bureau chief for the Dow Jones Newswire and the Wall Street Journal. In Russia, in Moscow itself, with this ban on exports, first, tell us, what are the big countries that Moscow and Russia was exporting to? And secondly, with this ban and some of these steps, is this creating political problems for the Russian political establishment?
Well, part of it was to alleviate political problems. But in general, Russia, first of all, I would add that Russia is very aware of what's happening with American farmers. Russians are very aware in general of what's going on in the U.S., though perhaps viewed through a different lens. So, and the wheat crop wasn't that bad in Siberia this year, but only in the more Black Sea European part of Russia. So they're quite aware of that. Russia exports to Egypt, to Bangladesh, to Middle Eastern countries. Much of the Russian grain crop is for feed, but some of it is for bread and human food as well. And the political problems were that some traders didn't want to be in a position where they'd sold locked-in wheat exports at a lower price. And the government also doesn't want to jeopardize the cattle industry, the hogs industry, the chicken and flour industry in Russia, by having them have to pay too high prices for grain, which may have led to the ban as well. The idea being that these are new growing industries, and any financial hiccup after the financial crisis could pretty much ruin them.
So, Jerry, back to you in Kansas. Explain, please, the connection between the livestock that William Maudlin was just talking about, and what you grow.
Well, we grow wheat. We also grow corn and soybeans and grain sorghum, which is a feed grain. And so wheat, naturally, if the price gets too certain low, you know, certainly too low, it'll go into feed production. And it was almost to that point previously this spring. And because of the protein, it's a high-quality feed, it'll go into the livestock industry. As the price comes back up, naturally it goes into the food chain.
Alan Tracy, here's a question from one of our listeners who emails us as following. His name is Mohammed. I was part of the United Nations team in Rome, Italy, that tracked the 1973-75 food crisis, and fear that this time the situation is much worse, he writes. The crop failures are more global, grain stocks are lower, but worse. Worst of all, this time there are many thousands of Wall Street speculators with access to almost limitless sources of funds. As usual, our politicians will react too late and come up with inadequate solutions, as happened in the past. So in the next 12 months, expect famine and food riots toppling many weak governments.
Okay. Well, it's kind of hard to predict the future in other places around the world, but certainly high prices do put poor places at risk. Our largest market for wheat from the United States this past year has been Nigeria, surprisingly enough, replacing Japan.
Well, we just heard that Russia exports largely to Egypt and to Bangladesh. These are regimes with plenty of potential destabilizing forces at work.
Yes, although I do think that the concern is at this point a little overstated. If the total production in Russia is down by 20 million tons, we're talking about carryout stocks, you know, just before the next new crop harvest in the world of about 180 million tons. So compare that. You know, that's three times the total U.S. crop that is out there in the world. Now, some of it's in places where it's not going to get out very much, like China and India. That puts more pressure on us to export. But I think what happens with weather around the world next year may be actually more important than what happens this year. Right now, the Russians in the winter wheat areas are having to postpone the potential of planting. So, you know, this could have an impact on next year as well. And if we have serious problems next year, we will have some more serious shortages.
I want to come back to that. Maximo, I know you want to jump in here.
No, just to agree on him. We have enough production right now and enough stocks. We have 192 million tons of stocks to be able to supply the market. So clearly it's not the situation that happened in 73. It's not the situation that happened in 2008.
So let me be clear. You're saying you are not concerned about global, worldwide shortages to the point that they're going to topple governments.
At this point, no. It shouldn't happen. As you have seen the last days, the price is starting to settle down. The supply is there. The U.S., as it was mentioned before, has had a good year this year, so they can supply and cover what is being reduced because of the losses in Russia. So unless additional supply shocks happen, then the situation could change, and that's where we need to be ready. What is important is how volatile these markets could be and how these small spikes can appear and can happen without the supply fundamentals being the ones pushing them.
Chris Hurt, I want to come back to you, the professor at Purdue, for a minute. When we saw a sudden rush, and now I'm going to switch a little bit into the corn market, when we saw the sudden, rush into corn ethanol, for example, there was a great concern that suddenly these stockpiles would be absorbed, turned from food to fuel, prices went up, there would be shortages, that kind of thing. How quickly do world supplies, world demand shift?
Well, actually, there is flexibility on the supply side in terms of if prices are high enough, profitability good enough, the producers of the world can respond. We have somewhat more acreage or land area that can be brought into production. But secondly, we have a lot of technology from fertilizers to various pesticides that can be used to help enhance yield. I think what we saw with the biofuels revolution, especially about 2006, was governments of the world becoming very aggressive on biofuels policy. Now, this biofuels policy, essentially, we were taking crops such as corn here in the United States and converting them into fuel, ethanol. And that did put pressure on our supply of using corn for food. In Europe, they used oil seeds to produce biodiesel. And we were very aggressive at that. So this created a large demand surge in 2006, 2007, 2008, and actually is continuing, but at a somewhat slower rate. Much of the problem in U.S. agriculture for the last 100 years really has been the ability of farmers to produce too much. When you produce too much, you're going to have low prices, low farm incomes, and low economic activity in rural areas of our country. So there was almost an attitude going into the biofuels era that there was an unlimited supply of crops in the world. I think what we saw was biofuels policy, particularly in the U.S. and Europe, came at a time when the supply just wasn't quite sufficient to meet that. Now, over time, I think supply can respond, but it did put additional pressures, upward pressures, on prices of grains.
We're going to go to the phones in a few minutes, but Jerry McReynolds, I want to come back to you, president of the National Association of Wheat Growers. You're a wheat farmer in Woodston, Kansas. You join us via your cell phone from the fields. I want you to talk for a moment and steer the conversation for a couple of minutes to whether you think that all this parallel discussion about climate change, global warming, is playing is starting to play out, that we're starting to see the effects. How you think about that, how you factor that into what you perceive from around the world and what you see happening in your own fields?
Well, climate change is a topic that's pretty hot right now. But, you know, during my lifetime, we've had climate change from year to year. And climate change, I don't see an awful lot of difference. We have had a little bit of difference in our cropping system. We've had a lot of improvement in technology. We've had a lot of improvement through research to put some drought resistance and water utilization and, you know, those types of things into some of the crops we grow. We don't have them in everything like we would like, but you know, I can't say that in our situation that it's a climate change issue. We have to deal with whatever the climate is. And I'm in a dry part of Kansas. All of our crops are dry land, and what we consider dry land, I mean, it is dry land, but what we consider a dry part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to deal with drought. We almost plan for it every year and then hope we don't get it. We started out this spring wetter than normal, and now we're drier than normal. And it's very hot, very dry, but we have to deal with whatever deck we're thrown. We can't just pick and choose. And so we try to use, in our situation, I try to use the moisture that I have available. If I have some moisture available, maybe I'll plant more corn, maybe more beans. If I am very short on moisture, I'll be planting wheat. And we have a rotation system. We plant wheat every year. We plant some corn. Generally, we plant milo, which is a little bit of a more drought-resistant feed grain. And if it's drier, well, I'll plant more milo. So we just have to, every year, we have to take not only test our soils, but check our moisture. And I'm not smart enough to predict what the weather's going to be like for that growing season. But you try to play the averages.
Jerry McReynolds, thanks very much. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Alan Tracy, quick comment on climate change, global warming, from the association perspective.
Well, our producers, as Jerry said, have to adjust and have to deal with the weather on a day-to-day basis. Climate change creates a political issue for producers because of all the carbon legislation that's ongoing, and the National Association of Wheat Growers is trying to deal with that as well. You know, there's no question that there is climate change. It's the question of what are the causes, and more important, though, is what we do about it, and that's the part where I don't think we have answers. I think we do trust that our producers have the ability to adjust and adapt pretty quickly as the situation evolves.
William Alden, want to come back to you to Moscow one quick second here before going to the phones. Just put in perspective for us once again the significance that this grain export business and agricultural exports generally mean for the Russian economy.
Well, it's a small part of the economy. One investment bank, Renaissance Capital, I believe, estimated it, all the related industries to agriculture and grain being about 1.5% of GDP. In a land of oil and gas exports, it's fairly small. But the point is the government wants this to be a healthy industry so they can diversify away from the oil and gas industry.
To the phones now, and Tom joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tom. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thank you for putting me on the air. In your intro, you mentioned that they were having problems with locusts, and I was curious to hear more about that. And I've also heard or read that Australia has had tremendous drought in recent years. So if your guest could talk about those two issues,
thanks,
and I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Alan?
Well, Australia does have apparently some very high numbers of eggs and ready to hatch in eastern Australia and New South Wales, which is a big wheat-producing state. Their biggest wheat-producing state, though, is Western Australia, as far away from Sydney and New South Wales as we are here in Washington from Chicago. that area has been dry. They had a pretty decent crop last year. Their growing season is just really getting underway. It's their winter right now. They planted in the fall, and they're coming out of winter now, and they are very short of moisture. So that contributes. In addition, the Canadians, usually the second or third largest exporter, had extremely wet and cold conditions early this year. So all of these things contributed to the spike that have increased wheat prices by 50% just since the end of June, just an extraordinary increase.
Let me just stop you for a second, because I hear you telling me about locusts and drought in Australia. We know what's been, because we've been hearing about it, is happening in Russia, banning their own exports, yet you're telling me that there's no danger. Maximo, talk to me about this. There's no danger of a global shortage or food riots or substantial price increases.
That's, again, it's very important to put this in context. You have countries which are producing more, and that's the case clearly of the U.S., which basically can cover the gap. So if you look to the global production, what you expect, a drop of 2.5% globally. So there is no reason to expect these problems of riots and so on like you had before. So it's very important to keep in context.
In context. I think I'll go out and buy my loaf of bread now. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. More in a moment.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Magazines are in trouble. Hundreds of periodicals folded last year, and the former powerhouse Newsweek was sold for just a dollar in exchange for millions in debt. What's ahead for the magazine industry in the digital age? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. I'm host of Planet Forward, which you can find at planetforward.org, and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. Maximo Torero, you were talking before the break about Australia and what we've been seeing taking place in Australia with locusts and drought and the problems they're having, and yet seeming not to have major effect with all these things on global supplies of wheat and food. So please continue.
What we know right now is the production of Australia is projected to be 440,000 tons less, which is basically below the average. So it shouldn't be too much of a problem. Also, we need to be aware that the government knew that this was going to happen, and they put a lot of measures to try to resolve it. So there were 43.3 million Australian dollars invested in spraying to avoid a problem. So we hope that the problems in the east will be resolved, and in the west seems that things are operating properly. So again, if we put everything in context, the Canadian case, which is reducing a little bit the production between 20% exports, the Russian case, which will affect 1.6 the global production, and the Australian case, right now you have enough supply, doesn't seem to be reflected in the little increase or spike that we saw in the last day. So that's what we are saying. Let's put this in context, and we shouldn't expect significant increase in the following days.
To the phones, Denise joins us from Bay City, Michigan. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I do have a question about India. I read an article in the paper this weekend that said that they have produced a great, great crop, but they don't have anywhere to store it. And so with the monsoons coming, it's rotting. And there's a big debate internally about distributing what they have to the poor, you know, rather than letting it rot. And that's a political hot potato. So I guess my question is, how can you not worry about people rioting, you know, with this shortage itself in India and elsewhere in the world? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Denise. Maxima?
Okay, you just mentioned that India have a good harvest this year. India is the second world producer, has 12.4% of the production at the world level. But it's not
of wheat.
But it's not the top exporter. It's not in the top five of the exporters. So a lot is self-consumed within India. So this is a great opportunity for India. If they have oversupply, you have good prices in the market, they can supply immediately to Egypt, which Russia is renegating on their contracts with Egypt, and to Northern Africa. So I see this as an opportunity for producers. But again, the important thing, and this is crucial, is that producers also want to see trends. They don't want to see volatility, because then they cannot make proper decisions. It's important for them to look at the trends, and we should try to avoid misinforming people and therefore reduce this volatility.
William Malden, what about trends the thought about where Russia's going? If this is, we hope, an aberration summer, then what?
You mean, Frank, you mean what would happen next summer
right.
if everything stays the same?
Right, right.
Well, that would be a big problem. Russia would have to re-examine what is a normal year and how much domestic consumption it has, how much it imports and exports.
No. I'm sorry. I don't mean if it stays the way it is, because I think we acknowledge and recognize that it's an aberration. In terms of what this summer does for projections for next year and beyond, planning, planting, that kind of thing. Is there talk about that, whether Russia expects to get back on track, resume its trend upward in production?
I think the main aspect here is the financial ability of farmers and the other companies that grow grain. And I think that's what the government's trying to address with more than $1 billion in various aid and loans to farmers. So there's a giant state bank that's supposed to help with that. So I think the concern is that the farmers won't have the financial wherewithal to continue, and that they'll need a little bit of help.
Alan, did you have something you wanted to
add? I was just going to add for Denise that the stock situation in India is huge. They have great supplies, and yes, they are losing some. They always do to spoilage, but there's going to be plenty of wheat in India. It's just always a very political issue in India because of the large number of people in very extreme poverty who are affected so much by the price, but the absolute supplies will be sufficient there.
Peter emails us from Tarrytown, New York. If the U.S. has such a large supply of wheat and can offset losses in Russia and other places, why should there be an increase in the cost of wheat and wheat products at all?
That's a good question. Wheat prices do respond to supply and demand. There was also a comment earlier about speculators. They are part of what makes the market. They're necessary to the market.
Do they destabilize the market?
I think that the fact that we've had these funds coming into the market in such big numbers has made the swings greater, made the volatility in prices greater.
And what is the impact of that in terms of what's happening in the fields and in the stores and to our wallets?
Well, you know, both buyers and producers have to adjust a little bit. I think for our producers, it's given them some opportunities to sell at the high prices when they can.
Maximo?
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. And speculators are good, but extreme speculation, that's the problem, because you're talking of food commodities and you're talking of consumers. So you need to be careful with that. And that's why this linkage of the food markets with the financial markets is dangerous, and we need to be careful with that.
And I would just add from the Moscow perspective that as a journalist, we try to provide information to the market and to consumers, but it's hard to get information sometimes here. It's not the most transparent process. When the grain union here cuts its forecast, it doesn't usually tell the press. You have to call them and ask them. The agriculture department sometimes announces it itself, or sometimes through the prime minister, and it seems like the grain forecast, which is not just wheat but all of grain, was being cut quite frequently by 5 million tons at a time. So I think a little bit of that uncertainty definitely contributed to some of the volatility that we've seen, still uncertainty.
Was that Chris Hurd I heard from Purdue?
Yes, it was. Ahead. I was just going to add from perspective, let's remember that food is basic to human survival. When you start to talk about shortage of food, that is going to raise excitement and certainly justifiably. Also, from perspective, we reached $13 a bushel on wheat futures in 2008. So this 841 is a high so far, still is far away from that.
I want to bring Bruce, who's calling in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, thanks for waiting.
Just the comments that you just made a few seconds ago is really about my question. Shouldn't this be a kind of a boost to the American economy a little bit here in the short term anyway? And is there any negative aspect of this that I'm not thinking about? I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks, Bruce. Alan?
Yeah, there is the potential. Obviously, these higher prices at a time when the U.S. has wheat to export means that we're going to ship perhaps $1 billion or more than we would have out of the United States, and that's significant. Yet at the same time, there certainly are some negatives. Whenever the governments interfere in the marketplace, it causes disruptions that come back and bite you later on. And these higher prices right now, right at the planting time for winter wheat in the Northern Hemisphere, are going to mean that we're going to have more wheat produced next year than we otherwise would have because of the government interference. So that creates those excess cycles, and in the long run, I don't think is good for our farmers, not to mention the Russian farmers. You know, the Russian farmers had an opportunity to get some high prices, and that's been squashed.
Maximum.
Exactly. That's the point we're trying to make. The volatility is not good for producers, neither for consumers. They want to see clear price signals. And basically, if we have these volatile markets, we could have problems and negative effects, too.
Back to the phone and Chip, who calls in from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Chip.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Earlier in the show, you guys were talking about the speculators and the surplus of cash that they have to invest in this stuff. Is there any thought as to what we can do to prevent those guys from artificially inflating the price, just trying to jack up the price to make more money and avoid, you know, taking advantage of a situation like they do with the oil crisis and stuff as far as fuel prices go?
Chris Hurd, you want to start us off on that?
Sure, a little bit, and certainly in Financial Reform Act that was passed and responsibilities of the regulators of those futures markets, the CFTC, was looked at very closely. There was mixed, research that really the objective research was difficult to say that for sure that the speculators were a major cause. We did see speculative activity increase, but we also saw commercials, that is, hedgers coming into the market, and that increased activity. But I think it is still unresolved. We need to watch pretty closely that speculative activity to see if there is any implication. But again, I think we have to back up. We're only seeing this in wheat at this time. In 2008, it was broadly across all agricultural commodities, through the metal commodities, and particularly into energy. Right now, we're only seeing this in wheat.
Do you have some concern that that could come back, that kind of broad-based speculation in these commodities, these important staples of our lives?
Well, I think right now I don't. And the reason for that is what we saw in early and mid-2008 was a general tone to expectation of inflation in prices. And we saw some of these funds that were investing for long-term inflationary hedges. They just wanted to buy commodities 1 and 2 years out for the opportunity of rising prices. Right now, we have a whole different tone with a slowly recovering world economy, with a tenuous U.S. economy. And right now, you're going to hear some discussion even about deflation of prices as a bit of a concern that the Federal Reserve has. So I don't think you're going to have that kind of investing.
What would yes, and we are hearing that concern about deflation. That's a word that seems to be creeping in. And I'm not sure that very many people really understand what that is, because there are not very many people who lived through the deflation of the Depression. But if deflation were to take place, just explain how that, or whether that would ripple through our agriculture, the food we consume, and what that would mean. Would that be a serious thing, Chris?
Well, I think deflation, we could think about it in housing, which all of us are somewhat aware of. why not buy that house now? Interest rates are very low. The house value has come down. But if we begin to expect broadly across the country that interest rates will go even lower and the house price will go even lower, then what we're going to do is defer consumption. We're not going to buy now. We're going to wait till later because our cash will buy so much later. Now, that really has a depressing effect on consumption and on the economic growth in the short run.
And bad for food?
Well, again, I think overall what we have right now is pretty much stability in terms of overall prices. Food prices are generally 1% or slightly under 1% inflation. So we don't have that tone to general inflation that was very much a worry back in 2008. I think that keeps some of these long-only speculators out of the market.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking today about global wheat supplies and the crisis that is being faced in Russia and other places to those supplies and the implications in our grocery stores, on our shelves, and in our pocketbooks. Back to Moscow for a quick second. William Alden, Moscow Deputy Bureau Chief for Dow Jones Newswire and The Wall Street Journal. As you're writing this story and watching this story, where do you see this going? What is this, you know, beyond the day-to-day air that people are having to breathe amidst the fires and the heat and what they're enduring, but the implications, the broader implications for the Russian economy, for the Russian political system, for the food supply, food chain?
Well, food is a major part of Russian consumer spending. It's a big part of inflation if food prices rise. So that's certainly something the government is looking at. But also, if you think about Russia as the biggest landmass of any country on Earth, and the agricultural potential, it means a lot to this country. There are very few people around farming that and living in the broad expanse of land. Most people are in cities. So this is certainly a big issue, and Russia really wants its agricultural industry to survive, and will take whatever steps it sees necessary to do that. And the latest step will be negotiating with Kazakhstan and Ukraine, the other big wheat exporters in the region, as a part of a customs union, to see what they can do together to alleviate the wheat problem, which may mean Russia taking some grain from Kazakhstan and Ukraine if the harvest forecasts fall any further.
Another call from Judy, who joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I just wanted to make a couple comments. Denial of the global warming isn't going to make it go away. Farmers don't practice crop rotation. The chemicals that they use to get a crop out, it's the same thing as using sewer sludge in some places to put on the crops, which creates dead earth. And the crops don't have a healthy immune at that point. There's nothing if they were grown biodynamically, sustainably. They don't have the ability to survive in a crisis because they're not coming from a healthy soil. It's not the way plants were meant to grow. And you really can't eat these fruits and these vegetables because the various fungicides and pesticides and algicides and everything, they stay adhered to the exterior of the plant. They put the wax on them and encase them. And then on the interior, they can also be grown up into the interior of the plant. So it's really not safe for immunosuppressed people with allergies.
So Judy, let me just jump in. Where do you get the food that you eat? If you don't trust anything that's being grown out there and you think it's all being poisoned with this stuff, do you grow all your own food?
No, I'm not a radical, no. I since living in North Carolina, I've learned a lot about agriculture. They have a wonderful farm tour here in the spring and sometimes in the fall. There are farmers here that grow things biodynamically and sustainably with proper crop rotation.
So you can find that information out, and that's the food that you seek for yourself.
I think that people don't know the proper questions to ask. It's like when you purchase anything. You believe these large companies that are pushing things down you. It's like the spliced genes in the seeds, the Roundup Ready. That is going around the world.
Okay, Judy, thanks very much. Alan Tracy, what about some of what Judy raises here and concerns that people have? You hear this a lot about the stuff that's sprayed, dumped, spread around their food.
Just that pesticide use on farms has been going down. You know, things that cost money have to be watched carefully. I believe that our producers are producing far more efficiently and far more sustainably than they ever have. I think that the soils of the Great Midwest are a massive carbon sink that actually helps the climate. So, and I believe our food supply overall is the healthiest that it has ever been.
Chris Hurt, I'm going to give you the last word here, and you can take us out on the nature of the food we eat.
Well, again, I think we have struggled for history of mankind to basically feed ourselves. As we look at the modern agriculture that we have, it is a system that is tremendously productive. We would not have been able to have the billions of humans on the earth that we have without this system. But in very wealthy countries, highly developed economies, there are people asking for other attributes in their food. We see that in this organic market and others, and I think, again, in the developed market, that's a great opportunity for people to have alternatives.
Okay, thanks to you. And thanks to our panel talking about a very important issue and some disturbing and yet also encouraging trends in the global food markets. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.